Hey, everybody, Alan Arnett here with another podcast on the blog at alanarnett.com. And look who is my guest, all the way from a very cold and snowy New Zealand, Guy Cotter. Hey, Guy.
Hey, Alan. How are you? Good to see you again.
I'm great. It's Friday, July 22nd here in Colorado, and I guess it's Saturday, July 23rd in Wanaka. So you're going to go skiing after this? It's about, what, 9:30 in the morning, you said?
Yeah, you've given me a good excuse to not get up too early to go skiing today. I'll have a chat to you and then mosey up during the warm part of the day and do some skiing or some ski touring on my local ski hill.
So how's the snow this year in the Southern Alps?
We've had a lot of snow. We've had a lot of really unusual weather, a lot of flooding, some quite big events going on. It's just been a really big winter for us down here. So, that's good from a skiing point of view, but there's been lots of, damage to infrastructure and roading and all the rest of it through the floods that we've had. So, more of that unusual weather.
Yeah, this time, I mean, the whole planet is experiencing that. We're on yet another day over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 40 C here in Colorado, which, when I first moved here in 1988, it was rare to have a day over 90. And now we have 15 or 20. Hey, listen, so thank you very much. I'm excited to talk with you about a number of subjects. And the most important, though, is let's talk about adventure consultants. A couple of years ago, in the midst of this, COVID pandemic, and I really admired your use of the word hibernation. You didn't say you were closing it. You didn't say you were shutting it down. You said you were going into hibernation. So give us a little background, Guy, on why you put adventure consultants into hibernation.
Yeah, well, we had a big operation going. I had 16 staff in my office in New Zealand and when the pandemic hit, and everything just shut down completely. New Zealand closed its borders. We couldn't travel. So it was really impossible for us to keep the operation rolling. And of course, with lots of expenses coming in, we had to make some big changes. So effectively, we closed down the operation temporarily, hibernated it, thinking that it would take some time to work through this process. Pandemics in the past have, looked like they last about 4 years. And it seems that, it seemed to us at the time that rather than dig ourselves a big hole we could never get out of, we were better to just cease operations and we would start up when things were looking better. So that's effectively what's happened the last couple of years. We've sort of been running the odd little trip here, a little bit in Europe and the odd thing in Antarctica and so on, but not much. And now that the world looks like it's getting ready for travel again and to accept us and for the social impacts and physical impacts that we might have had on those remote locations that, we could have carried COVID to. Now that all seems to have moved through, then we're in a position to start operating again, which is very exciting.
Yeah. So I think one of the things that you alluded to was that going forward that you're going to make some strategic changes to how you run the expeditions and the company and things. In full disclosure, Guy and I go back to the late 90s. I guess Amit Ablam was one of the first ones, and Choi Oyu and some others, and then Everest. So, I've always been a great admirer of you personally and of adventure consultants of the entire operation for really just the, Andorje and the whole group of the professionalism that you've always executed. So I assume that it's an and, so it'll be all the great things in the past and what's going to be different in the future.
I think scale is probably something that we're looking at getting right at this stage, because we just can't go straight back to what we were doing. We had a massive operation operating all over the world, doing lots of amazing trips and to all the seven continents and lots of other things going on, a climbing school here in New Zealand and Europe and so on. So scale is the thing that's going to be changing a lot. We're going to actually be doing initially a lot less that we can do well. I've got a small core staff that is now back working with us, which is very exciting. And we're starting with some post-monsoon expeditions in Nepal. We've got a Manaslu and various other treks and trekking peaks and so on. And then we'll rebuild to spring next year. We'll be back on Everest, looking at doing the Triple Crown again, which is something that I came very close to achieving in 2018, but just missed out on the summit of Nupsi by a couple of hundred meters. And by my research, I don't think anybody has completed them all completely in a season, even though Kenton Cole suggests that he did. Other people who were there said that they weren't quite at the summit.
Right.
So looking to go back and do that, as well as a Europe operation has been quite busy, back to Antarctica, back to Aconcagua in South America. So it's really just about distilling it down to the seven summits, the core things that we do, and just probably having a slight change in focus. We're definitely going to be going for just working with discerning clients. There's a lot of people out there who are going for the mass market, and that's great. There's plenty of room for all of them. We just want to do things in a quality sort of a way that gives me meaning as a person. I only want to do things that are meaningful. So that's the approach moving forward.
So kind of a quality over the quantity, and instead of having 100 people on Everest, you know, maybe a nice core team of 8 to 12.
Exactly, that sort of approach, yes. And we've never gone for, you know, large groups. It's never been my approach. When we've filled up our expedition, I've always said, okay, we're full. You know, that's it. And I've always liked being able to operate like that, because for me, it's not about money. It's actually about running quality mountaineering expeditions with people. And it's still about the people aspect of it, you know, that I still think is, for me, the aspect of it that I enjoy most, and I like to share that with the people that we're on our expeditions with.
So when you talk about the seven summits, and for example, on Kilimanjaro or on Everest, are you be able to get your previous local staff back together?
Yes, absolutely. And that's been something that we've maintained throughout this whole period, is keeping, you know, the majority of our core staff together. Certainly in Nepal, our operations team is still there, as well as our Sirdars. So we're really excited about working with them again. Through all of this period, we've still maintained our Sherpa Future Fund, which you know, through to the generosity of a lot of our client base, we've been able to provide schooling for all of the kids who have lost their fathers in mountaineering accidents. And so we've got 15 kids now going through the schooling in Nepal, and full board and everything else. So that's been an ongoing focus even through the last couple of years when we haven't been operating.
So I'll put that link on the screen, but just to emphasize that. So it's the Sherpa Foundation and Adventure Consultants, through the generosity of donations, is currently supporting 15 children from Sherpas who have lost their lives in the climbs.
Absolutely, yes. And that's actually wonderful. A couple of them, the last couple we picked up, had lost parents through COVID. So so that's our Sherpa Future Fund. So operated through Adventure Consultants, and we've just focused on having the kids in high quality boarding schools to ensure their ongoing education. And so since 2014, we've been looking after the welfare and the education of those children. And some of them are about to graduate, while some of them are still, you know, quite young. So it's been really good to see how they've move forward and given them that opportunity in life that their fathers were trying to get for them, and that's why they're working in the mountains.
I love that. You know, on Dorje's brother, Kami, you know, he's my guardian angel in the mountains. I love Kami to death. And, you know, of his five kids, his youngest son, Mingma, is an electrical engineer in Nepal. And his oldest daughter, Dawa, is doing an internship in London and hospitality. And his youngest daughter, Karma, wants to be a doctor, and she's entering medical school. So very different than like Kami and Andorje, who, I don't know about Andorje, but I know Kami didn't go to school, and their father didn't. So very different life for the Sherpas now through this, you know, arguably a treacherous profession, but nonetheless, they're making a better life for their children.
Absolutely they are. Yes, it was so good to see.
Hey, so I love you talk about Seven Summits in Antarctica. You look, throw that in. I know you're an avid skier. So just a quick question. Which one do you, if you only had to go to one place or the other, would you go to Everest or to the South Degree or Antarctica? Which one?
That's a really hard question to put to me, Alan. It's completely unfair. Probably Antarctica for the environment because it is so harsh and so amazing and kind of life affirming in lots of ways, and Nepal and to Everest for the people. Those are the different things that I get from both of those different locations. And luckily enough, they don't happen at the same time of year, so I can do both.
Okay, so it's an and. All right, you get away with that one. I remember meeting you, by the way, or not meeting you, but seeing you in 2011. Actually, it was December 2010 at Union Glacier, and we were both struggling with our communication devices, trying to upload, you know, blogs. And that was a lifetime ago back then when we started doing that stuff.
Oh yeah, and I've got bins of all of that old comms gear that we used to use. You know, that is just.
Which is useless.
Just can't use it. It's useless. Yeah, maybe one day they'll do a museum, but
we can donate.
Yeah, or maybe when we're in purgatory, you know, they'll make us have to try and reconnect all of our comms again to pay for all of our sins.
I'm in trouble. So you mentioned Manaslu and the other 8,000 meter mountains. That's a good segue to talk about kind of the what's going on in the world of high altitude mountaineering. And, you know, by my calculation, this past spring in Nepal was, I've never seen anything like it since I've been following this since, you know, 1997. You know, we saw multiple linkages of 8,000 meter mountains, Annapurna, then Dalagiri and Kanchenjunga, and, you know, Makalu, not to mention Everest Lhotse, which was kind of common to link those two. But then all of a sudden we started seeing so many people climbing 3, 4, 5 in one season. Never, it's been done a few times, but never to this scale. What do you think's the root? What do you think's going on here?
Well, I saw the start of all of this happening. You know, Rob Hall and Gary Ball were doing this back in, you know, the early 90s and linking up a couple of peaks.
Yeah.
Helicopter logistics was so much more difficult and expensive in those days. And obviously helicopters are so much more prevalent in Nepal. It's so much easier to go from one peak to another, people holding acclimatization and so on. So I think it's kind of only natural that this was going to happen. You know, there are people who are going, you know, this is not mountaineering, you know, whatever. I mean, there's always detractors for new things that occur.
Yeah.
You know, it's really interesting for me to see what's happening. It's great. I think it's probably a little bit like when sport climbing first came out. Mm. People said, this isn't climbing, this isn't rock climbing, you know, and look at our perception of sport climbing now. So I think over time people will get used to this as a process, and it may fade out for a bit. Obviously for some people it's you know, it's really appealing because they get to do a whole bunch of 8,000 meter peaks at once. To me, it's a very athletic activity. It's kind of like a series of marathons being run together, you know, rather than, I suppose, the older concept we used to have about an expedition having a beginning and a middle and end, and it was about the journey and so on. I think there's less about the journey in today's people as opposed to, you know, maybe just ticking off peaks and getting back to the office as quickly as possible. You know, that style of approach, it's unique. And like you said, it really exploded last season on Everest, and I guess we're going to see more of it. I mean, I think we're still going to have some issues, people trying to do all of the 14 with Choya Yu and Shisha Pangma not opening up, but
yeah, you
know, we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, you know, there's definitely a market for this of you know, people leveraging the travel and the training and the acclimatization. So, you know, going from one to the other is drastically different than was done, you know, 20, 30 years ago. You know, if you look at K2 as a case study right now, Pakistan issued 475 permits. I just did a post on this and went through and calculated how many people summited. It was, I think I said 128. in the last 24 hours, and that smashed the previous record of 62. And there's probably still, it's hard to tell, but there's probably still another 50, maybe even 100 people that may try to, you know, try to nab it. They're very fortunate at the moment of having some pretty good weather. You know, did you ever think, I wrote a blog in 2016 of why K2 will never become, or why K2 will never become Everest. And yeah. I put in the blog today, I was wrong. Did you ever think that we would see these type of numbers on K2?
Not really. You know, the weather over in Pakistan, from my experiences there, is like you get some seasons that are good and some that are bad. And if you're there on a bad one, then, you know, and you've got a, you know, high avalanche hazard and all the rest of it, then the chance is a lot less likely. Very similar with what happened last season in Nepal. I mean, we seem to be having, you know, some pretty stable weather patterns occurring in the high Himalaya. And you know, that's not actually necessarily a good thing, but and that is probably means warmer temps overall. But, you know, while we're seeing all of this weird weather and, you know, various different zones, just seems to me that the Himalayas has stabilized. So, you know, I remember talking to Brashears way back about what was going on in the 80s with climbing. He said there were very, very few summits on Everest in the 80s. And he put it down to the weather. The weather was a lot worse through that whole decade. The 90s stabilized out. You know, there was always that sort of fine spell in mid-May. That each decade may have different weather that's associated with it. So just because it's happening now, I mean, it could change in the future. It could become more stable, it could become less stable. But, you know, congratulations to everybody who's, you know, got up there, and obviously you in the past, Alan. You know, it's obviously a, you know, a major accomplishment to climb K2, even though there are bigger numbers there. And obviously the number of Sherpa teams that are there are really helping with strength on the mountain and the fixing and the management on the mountain.
Yeah, in 2014, I think we had 48 total summits the entire season. And I think there was one team yesterday that had 48 members. So, And to your comment about the support ratio, I just did the calculation. For every member, every client, there was 1.7 support climber. Right. 95% of those were Sherpas brought in by the major Nepali companies, but then also a few of the Pakistani high altitude workers, as they're called, but, you know, support.
Yep.
A question along those lines, Guy, do you see Pakistan developing an infrastructure similar to what Nepal has? Where do you think they are in that evolution?
It's an interesting question. The issue there, of course, is that you don't have a population base of support high altitude climbers who live in the mountains. You know, when I've been over there, they've drawn in people from all over. They're not, you know, all from Skole or Huche or whatever. And I think this is a very major difference, is that the Sherpas are genetically prepared, you know, from living at high altitudes. And that, I think, will always be an issue in Pakistan, is trying to, they can't replace the Sherpas completely. I mean, there are obviously a few very strong climbers there, but it's not, a caste or an entity of people like the Sherpas. So from that point of view, I think there's going to be always be a demand for Sherpas in Pakistan. But, you know, the Pakistan does seem to be stabilizing somewhat at this point. You know, however, there is still the potential of political issues. What we saw on Nanga Parbat, when was that, back in
2011, I think, or 12.
It was 11, yeah. You know, just issues like that can still pop up. And I know the Pakistanis are working very hard on trying to ensure things remain stable, but they haven't always been, you know, able to maintain that. So, you know, my feeling is that it can't become what Nepal is, but, you know, they've got 5 of the 8,000 meter peaks. So there's a big demand to go there, and you know, good to see it happening. It's a beautiful country, Pakistan.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I think that's is actually very encouraging is the youth movement that we're seeing in the mountains, the youth and the females that are, you know, there were three females, two from Pakistan, one from Iran. I think those were the three that were the first of their countries this year that summited K2. And then, of course, you've got, you know, just a lot of under 25 climbers that are just knocking it out of the park right now. Mm-hmm. So that actually makes me very optimistic for the future of our sport, that we're seeing young people engaged and, you know, being aggressive and trying to, you know, set some records themselves.
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, that's a very good point. And, you know, and I think what is obviously in it for them is, you know, the notoriety of doing this. But, you know, as we've always probably shared the belief that, you know, there's something very meaningful about climbing big mountains and the challenges that are associated, that, which is, you know, we need to see the younger people jazzed by climbing. And there's got to be something in it. You know, maybe it's the new image that we're seeing some people portraying, you know, that's more youthful rather than, you know, than the old folks. So, you know, that's all good.
Yeah, speaking of records and those type of things, you know, there's a lot of chatter right now within the mountaineering community, and I'm not sure it's outside of that, about this whole idea of standing on the true summit of a mountain. And a recent analysis done by the team at 8000ers.com, I guess they concluded that, you know, of the, I think it's around 35 people that claimed all 14 of the 8,000 meter mountains, and only three have really done it. And they went back and looked at the history, and you're a very unique person to have this discussion around, because Manaslu has been kind of exhibit A in this discussion. And I know that when I summited Manaslu in 2013, I got to the four summit, but I was told by Russell Bryce's Purbatashi, you know, the god of climbing at that time with the record number of summits, that we were on the true summit, and he had fixed the ropes to it. So I believe that, and absolutely, you know, I would swear, well, look, I was told that. Then this drone thing came out a couple of years ago, or last spring or last autumn. And then, but I saw where you talked about standing on the true summit of Manaslu. And what year was that, Guy?
2012, but it was in the spring.
Okay. And it was not in, there was not a lot of snow on that ridge, because the issue is that you have the four summit and then it drops down into this very dangerous soft cornice before you get another a little bit higher to the true summit.
Yes. Well, above the false summit that you got to, there was an apex of the ridge above it, which I was thinking might have been the summit. So I climbed up to it, which took a little bit of plowing. You know, it was probably, I suppose, 15 meters or something above that sort of ceremonial summit. But then there was a ridge traverse, probably 50, 60 meters through to the true summit, which took a little bit of effort to get, and it wasn't very protectable, and I wasn't too sure about the cornice. But then when I actually went on to the true summit itself, it was consisted of very rotten rock, being, you wouldn't see that in the fall. In fact, so rotten that it was almost impossible to get a good anchor on to fix a rope to get my client up to. And but I managed to, because of my skills in some of the New Zealand mountains where, yeah, you know, the rock consistency isn't that great, I managed to use my ice axe to create a bollard to in the rock to put a sling around and, you know, get up to the true summit, which is very clearly the true summit. So it's a different route from what Mingma G took when he sort of dropped below the false summit and then went around the corner and then up the slope. You know, maybe he was more concerned about the cornice than what I could see, because from that false summit you can actually see, if you look around the other side of the ridge, you can look at the back of the cornice, and there's actually some photos that came out in that Damien Gildea article and so on, showing where we were along the ridge. You could actually see us photos that were taken from that lower point. But yes, bringing up that whole argument about true summit, not true summit. I mean, I think for most of us, it probably doesn't matter too much. You know, if you thought you went to the summit, you know, you thought you went to the summit. But for people who are claiming records, you know, all the 8,000 is for, you know, obviously being the classic that you actually want to have proof. In this day and age, anybody who claims they've climbed all the 8,000 meter peak should really back it up with, you know, their GPS course, because of course everybody has got a GPS watch or whatever, and we're not, haven't been seeing a lot of evidence that people are providing to back their record up. And I mean, it's almost going to get to the point soon where there's going to be so many people doing it that it's, well, if you're going to say you've done it, then you've got to prove it, rather than just say you've done it. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, all sorts of people with egg on their faces around the world at the moment who are, you know, supporting people who have claimed to have done the 8,000 meter peaks who haven't. And I was watching all of this go on as it was transpiring back in the 90s, you know, Ed Vieses and Vacuous Stuffs and, you know, going for the 8,000 meter peaks, and Ed returning to Shishapangma, you know, at least a couple of times, and Vaker three times on Dalagiri, you know, just to ensure that they had actually tagged the true summit. So even back then, everybody knew that there was a true summit. And I think a lot of people have been fudging the edges of credibility, thinking that nobody's going to come up with evidence to dispute it. Now that's happened, I think it's a good thing. Moving forward, I don't see how there's any benefit in taking away everybody's summits, especially if they thought they were there at this point. But I think moving forward, you're either on the summit or not.
Yeah. It, that's probably the ultimate question is, do you go back and rewrite history? And I think, you know, Billy Barreling and the team at the Himalayan Database, at least with respect to Manaslu, made the determination that they're not going to go back and, you know, put an asterisk beside everybody's name. But going forward, exactly what you said, they're going to require some level of, you know, empirical evidence that's indisputable rather than just taking your word for it. Somebody the other day gave me an analogy. He said they thought that now the 14,000 meter mountains were becoming the seven summits, which I thought was apt and sad.
Yeah. I hear you. You know, good for mountain tourism, which is what it is. You know, good for the industry in lots of ways. You know, they're good for profile, probably for mountaineering, something that is the new realm, because we don't want it to just sort of sit where it was, you know, 50 years ago. We want things to move on. And maybe, you know, that might, you know, transpire that people then go and do new climbs, new routes, winter ascents, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, you got a question with mountaineering, high altitude mountaineering, whether we were pushing the limits so far that a lot of people were dying because of what was the objective, the one that's going to get you noticed, the one that's going to, you know, get you you know, maybe even some sponsorship. And a lot, yeah, so, you know, climbs in winter, solo climbs, massive climbs, I mean, people were dying regularly, and new routes and so on, you know. So maybe this is you know, it's not that hardcore alpinism, it's sort of high altitude athleticism and combined, you know, with good logistics and strategies in order to make all of this happen. You know, I mean, it's exciting in a way, but it shouldn't detract from the person who just wants to go and do an 8,000 meter peak. That's still just as hard and just as valid, you know, as it ever was. So you know, we can cover a whole bunch of objectives and desires out there, because not everybody wants to go and do all 14,000 meter peaks.
Yeah, I kind of put people in two buckets. There's the recreational climber, of which I would include me as that. And then there's the professional climber, and I'd put you in that, you know, because that's how you make your living, or people that are sponsored, or people that truly are going to declare they've set this record. I think there's a different standards for those two. But I think that the common denominator between a recreational and professional is personal integrity. and being candid and transparent about what you accomplished.
Yeah.
Hey, one last thing as we wrap this up. I was thinking about this the other day relative to climate change and especially this past spring, like we talked about, you know, the month of May was a summit window, weather window on the 8,000 meter mountains with a couple of exceptions. But I was thinking about the Khumbu Icefall, the instability, and then the huge crevasses in the Western Khum. And I was reflecting on sitting in a tent, and I'm sure there was scotch involved with Russell Bryce, back in, you know, 2011 or something. And he was showing me these pictures of the crevasses, and he made this assertion that was now, this is now 11 years ago. He made this assertion that one day that the Icefall and the Khum will be unclimbable due to the instability and the, just the sheer magnitude of these crevasses. And then we're going to have to make a decision as to whether taking a helicopter to Camp 2 on the Nepal side, is that cricket? You know, is that still fair style? Mm-hmm. What are your kind of top of, I know I didn't, you didn't know I was going to ask you this, go down this
road.
No. But I was just thinking about what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that in many ways, the depletion of the Western Khum and the Khumbu Icefall doesn't really seem to have made it too much harder yet. You know, there are some years that the Icefall seems to be relatively accessible, and then of course it's more difficult once you get out the top of the Icefall because of the size of the crevasses, you know, below Camp 1 especially. So, you know, I've obviously wondered that a lot myself, and I do also think that, you know, potentially it might get easier. It may even get safer. I mean, who knows? More ice doesn't necessarily mean it's safer. So I hope I'm not going to be around to find out when things have melted out all the way to Camp 2 and whether we, you know, have to even think about helicopters. We'll probably all have personal drones at that point. We can just fly wherever we want and get dropped off and picked up and taken back to base camp for dinner and then pop back up to the high point the next day.
Or just sit at home with your VR and just, you know, go visit it, you know, while,
yeah,
you know.
All of that. I mean, we're joking, but, you know, sadly these things are changing. You know, I was on South Col and I think it was 2013, and there was basically a river running through South Col. The weather had been so warm, and to see that all happening in the time frame that we've been going to the mountains is quite shocking. But you know, we're faced with a reality, and you know, things will change, and we'll have to change our approach to doing things. Like in New Zealand, a lot of the mountains are only accessible for a very short period of time. I see that sort of thing happening in Europe as well. You know, in the springtime, you've got all the snow cover, you can get around, but then as summer comes on, then things are falling apart. And without the integrity of the glaciers holding the mountains up, you know, they are starting to fall to bits. So, you know, it's a very sad case of rapid destruction of the mountain zones.
Yeah, Mont Blanc is really suffering at the moment. They've basically shut down the mountain for these very reasons. Mr. Cotter, thank you, sir. Always a pleasure, and I just admire your professionalism, your history, and what you've done with Adventure Consultants, and eager to see continued success with, you know, you, Suze, and the whole AC team. So
thanks very much, Alan. No, it's great to be here and to chat to you, and a bit of reminiscing, but also thinking about the future. So, you know, thank you for keeping everybody informed, and we'll look forward to a chat again in the future.
All right, sounds good. Take care.
Take care.